Daniel chapter 7. Let's open up in prayer and we'll get started. Father, thank you for the opportunity to be working through the book of Daniel over the past months. It's been really encouraging to see your faithfulness to the exiled people and to see your believers there in Babylon, far from home, but not far from you, and how you drew near to them, how you're sovereign over the nations, and that you have a plan. So as we come to Daniel chapter 7 and the chapters ahead of us, we are all entering into difficult and deep waters, and may you give us a measure of humility as we dig into this material, and may we not get lost in the details, but see the big picture and also see a big God, and a God who is big but yet near to us, and a God who will win in the end. So help us now as we cover this material, and we pray this in Christ's name. Amen. Okay. Oh, thank you. Does anybody in here dream and then wake up and remember it? Raise your hand if you ever do that. Where you can remember it like really well, like you start writing it down because it'll be your next book someday.
Yeah.
Daniel the prophet here in front of me, has that happen? So sometimes I go through phases where I can do that. I don't know if it's stress or tiredness or what it is, but where everything is vivid. And I sometimes remember my dreams. I hate when I remember my dreams and it's a nightmare, though. I mean, I hate that. Like the one time I had a dream where I woke up late on a Wednesday, and I had forgotten to study for a calculus test. And so I went into a test without having studied for it. And then I woke up and a little tear streamed down my cheek. It was just a nightmare. So for me, that is a nightmare, to not study for a test. For you, you may have different nightmares, but sometimes we remember these dreams. Daniel remembered his dream. And it was the stuff of nightmares. It was the stuff of nightmares in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel has a dream, he has a nightmare, and the angel is going to interpret it for him. The first bit of the book of Daniel, other people have dreams and Daniel interprets them. Second half of the book of Daniel, Daniel has dreams and others interpret it for him. The tables have turned in the second half of the book. And when we come to the material in Daniel chapter 7, in many ways the material here should make us tremble and be filled with anxiety. But the theme of this passage is not to give us nightmares, but to calm us in our nightmares and to give us hope that the sovereign God will win in the end. But make no mistake about it, you haven't read Daniel chapter 7 rightly until you've had nightmares from what you've read. Till you're trembling in what we find in these words. In this chapter, which is an incredible chapter, this English little phrase, keep looking, and I kept looking, is used 10 times. Daniel kept looking. He kept looking at it. His eyes were continuously looking at this dream. And I think we're going to see that as a bit of a theme as we come through these dreams, that we're going to have to keep looking at the right things. keep our eyes on the right things in order to have hope in the midst of what we are to find in these prophecies. We can get lost in the details of the prophecies of the end of the book of Daniel. I have a hermeneutic that deals with the details of the text of Scripture. I'm going to do that. I'm going to follow my hermeneutic wherever it takes me in this book of Daniel. I'm committed to that, to see what happens. However, I think many people, and I fell prey to this as well, come to these things and get lost in the details and miss the big picture of what the prophet is trying to say to believers of all the ages. And this is what we can agree on, all of us. Believers in Jesus Christ have a hope for our futures in spite of suffering and sin. We have a great hope in our future in spite of this hard road home to heaven. I think really that's the message of the entire book of Daniel. In many ways, that hope becomes quite specific in Daniel chapter 7. But so does the horror. The hope becomes specific, but the horror is real in Daniel chapter 7. It's really the stuff of nightmares. Really, we're going to see that God's sovereign here again, which is the theme of the book, but we're going to see that he is sovereign over every single evil nation that's ever risen in humankind. And in the end, he's going to give his people his own everlasting kingdom through the Son of Man. It's incredible, the scope of this passage. It's been a while since we've been in Daniel. We've got a handout. Does everybody have a copy of this handout? If you don't, there's a couple extra ones here. Take a look at it. Let me just show you where we are in Daniel. It's been a while. We've covered chapters 1 through 6, which is historical narrative, so it's all really in story format. Now we go into prophecy, apocalyptic prophecy, in the last 6 chapters. As we said, Daniel's been interpreting others' dreams, and now an angel interprets Daniel's dreams. Okay, you can see the rulers that were involved, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, Darius, and all of that at the bottom. And just take a look at this. But the one thing that I want to highlight here is that chapter 2 through chapter 7 is written in Aramaic. So still, we're in Aramaic. And I think it's important because chapter 2 begins in Aramaic with a dream of a statue. And chapter 7 ends in Aramaic with a vision of 4 beasts. It forms a bit of an inclusio, if you know, where you get the same thing at the beginning and at the end of a body of literature. And so we're meant to see that the interpretation of the dream of the statue is to inform our interpretation of the vision of the 4 beasts, the beginning and end of the Aramaic section. The Aramaic section, a language that was accessible to all the world. God wanted this revelation of 2 through 7 to go to the whole world. In chapters 8 through 12, we go back to the Hebrew tongue, and we're going to look more specifically, at the Hebrew nation and the future of the Jews in that passage. Okay? So, that's kind of a big picture of the overview. You can put this aside now. I hope that helped a little bit as to where we have been. Now we're going to start covering Daniel chapter 7. I should probably get my Bible out. That would be a good idea. And so if you're not there, turn to Daniel chapter 7. And what I want to do today, wow, it's late. I want to do today is look at the actual vision of the beasts and kind of compare them to chapter 2. But I'm also going to spill over and really go through the entire chapter just from an overview standpoint, just so you see where we're going. The next time we're going to come back in chapter 7, we're going to circle back to what Daniel emphasizes in this passage and see how it all ties together. So that's kind of what we're going to do. I don't have a handout for you. I probably should have. I don't have it. I apologize for that. Maybe you can take notes. as we go. I think handouts will be probably more helpful in this last half. It's going to get pretty complicated. So for today, I think we can handle it because it's just two headings. The chapter is broken up into two basic headings. The vision he saw. Okay, so the vision Daniel saw in verses 1 through 14. And of course, 15 through the end of it is the interpretation of the vision. We'll keep it simple. The vision he saw and the interpretation for today. Now, when did Daniel have this dream, this vision? Well, the date was 553 BC, 14 years before the fall of Babylon. Okay, this is in the first year of Belshazzar's reign. That's probably Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. Basically, if you think back and you look at your sheet, this dream happens between chapters 4 and 5 on your sheet. So look at your sheet. This dream happens between Nebuchadnezzar and that dream of the great tree. And then Nebuchadnezzar says, I'm really proud about that, even though I should be humble. And God humbles him like crazy, turns him into a beast for 7 years. And then he repents and believes. I believe he was saved. In contrast to his grandson Belshazzar, who knew all that and did not humble himself. And we have a case study of what it looks like when you don't humble yourself before the Almighty God in chapter 5. And this dream is put smack dab in the middle of those two chapters. And that's important because I think it helps in some of our interpretation to see where these dreams fit. That's the timing of the dream. So, actually, I have my text right in here, so that's going to work well. Look at verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down. And sometimes I've done that. And related the following summary of it. So what did Daniel see in the dream? Verse 2. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. And so this great sea refers to the mass of humanity in the scriptures. And so the idea here, and the sea is stirred up. It's roiling. It's a storm. Ethan and Allie haven't had their honeymoon yet, but they did go up north for their couple days before they had to go back to nurse. She had to go back to nursing school. While they went up there, you remember the weather that day. They were up on the shores of Lake Superior. 15-foot waves were whipped up, coming crashing in Lake Superior. The sea was in turmoil. This is the state of the sea, blown by the wind from all winds of heaven, speaking probably of God's sovereign winds blowing over the affairs of humanity. And this humanity is all broiled up and in turmoil. And out of this tumultuous, stormy, chaotic water come the four beasts. Monstrosities. They are not animals. This is not a zoo chapter. These are not, there's a bear that came out. There's a leopard that came out. We're missing it. These are monsters. This is the stuff of terror. This is the stuff of nightmares. They're blood hungry, distorted, nasty animals. The first is somewhat like a lion. Verse 4. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. It kept looking until its wings were plucked. So the wings got ripped out. And it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. And I believe this is a symbol of Babylon, of Nebuchadnezzar, the king, and of Babylon. So you're going to see all through the Bible, including the Gospels, when Jesus comes, when he comes as the king, he brings the kingdom. Same here. The king represents the kingdom. And so you got Babylon, you got sometimes it'll talk about a king, but it could be talking about, you know, the whole kingdom, and it's represented by the king. So this is Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. In fact, Jeremiah 49:19 says this, Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar is spoken of as a lion from the thickets of the Jordan in Jeremiah 49:19. Ezekiel chapter 17 and verse 3, Nebuchadnezzar is described as a great eagle with great wings because his armies could move with great speed. So this is the nation of Babylon from 605 to 539 BC. And in fact, the Ishtar Gate of Babylon is covered with pictures of lions with eagles' wings. This was a symbol of Babylon. And it's interesting to note that the wings were plucked out, which reminds us of right where this dream was plopped. When Nebuchadnezzar was humbled and his wings were plucked out and by God's chastening hand, his wings were plucked out, divine passive. God plucked him out. It was Nebuchadnezzar's pride. He was removed from his kingdom. He was made to look utterly insane. He was a beast. For 7 years, he lost dominion of his kingdom. It was given back to him after he repented and surrendered to, and I think believed in, the God of Israel. And that's what I think it means when a human mind was given back to him. I think it's a whisper of his regeneration as his mind and his sanity returned. As one has said, quotes, the spiritual transformation God accomplished within him that is here symbolized by the beast nature being transformed into a human nature, end quotes. This is Babylon, whose king was the humbled Nebuchadnezzar. The second beast is in verse 5, the Medo-Persian Empire from 539 to 331 BC. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, resembling a bear. It's kind of lopsided, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. They were bloodied, I'm sure. Don't think of this clean little zoo animal. This is horrific. I wish we had a drawing of it. It might help us. And thus it was said to it, arise, devour much meat. So it was resembling a bear. It's really gross. It's distorted and humpback. I thought of that book that we read from, what's the name of that again? The Wing Feather Saga. Maybe it would have looked like that one. I don't want to ruin it for anybody. I won't tell you who that was. It's really gross, distorted, ugly, and bloodied, and ribs in its mouth. It's the stuff of nightmares. The stuff of terror. But it's a good description, we'll see, of the Medo-Persian Empire. Medo-Persian, two parts. Got two unequal sides of this beast. Less majestic and swift than the lion, lopsided. One side more than the other. A dual aspect, just like the second kingdom, which was that big statue, and they had the two arms of silver. Had a little bit of a two-pronged nature to that second kingdom here. Two-pronged nature to that. Probably one side raised up is probably the superiority of the Persians over the Medes. And if you're not certain about that, that will be made absolutely explicit in chapter 8. That it's talking about the superiority of the Persian aspect of the Medo-Persian Empire. The three ribs between its teeth is the prey of the kingdom that it conquered, so that the three kingdoms, the Medes and Persians, had to conquer before they rose to world power. The three ribs were then Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt are the three ribs and the three nations that they conquered. And they rose and they devoured much flesh, which means they took over far more land than any prior kingdom, which history has proven out. After this next verse indicates, now each of these monsters come in sequence. There's one followed by the next, and after that, and so on. These are sequential rising of these monsters. Verse 6, after this I kept looking. Here's the third beast. Behold, another one, like a leopard. Not a leopard, but like a leopard. He's trying to describe it with an animal that's as close as he can get to the real thing. It's like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. As point of fact, leopards don't have four wings of a bird on them. But this leopard, or one like a leopard, had four wings of a bird. It also had four heads. It's the stuff of nightmares. And dominion was given to it. Monstrosity, a vicious leopard, wings on its back, We know that leopards are extremely fast, and if you put the idea of wings on a leopard, you've got a kingdom that conquers with incredible speed. This represents Greece, the third kingdom under the reign of Alexander the Great from 331 to 63 BC. Alexander the Great within 10 years. How's this for getting something done? In 10 years, by the age of 32, he had conquered the entire Medo-Persian Empire all the way to the borders of India. And it is said when he had conquered all of that land at the young age of 32, he wept because there were no more land to conquer. In fact, he was so depressed, many historians think it led to his early demise. Which explains why there's four heads. Because out of that leopard rose up four heads. That is four kings, four rulers, four generals that took over as that Greek, as Greece split into four heads. And that's filled out for us in chapter 8. In fact, chapter 8 is going to be a focus on the middle two beasts and their relation to Israel. But for now, we're just getting the big picture. And these four heads are, I'll list them for you. We're not going to have a quiz at all at the end. Ptolemy, from the south, kind of Egyptian area. So south and the Ptolemy, Libya, Egypt, Palestine, southern Syria region. The second general is Seleucus from the north. Take careful attention of the north and south, because the east and west of these four kind of fall out in biblical prophecy. But the north and the south kings are a big deal as we come into further prophecies in the book of Daniel. You'll see that as we go along. So Ptolemy in the south, Seleucus in the north, Syria, Cilicia, Mesopotamia, and a guy named Lysimachus, Thrace, Bithynia, and a guy named Cassander, Macedonia, and Greece. So there's four generals, and we're going to see the north and south ones come big time in prophecy for Greece. We get to the fourth beast. The fourth beast, he doesn't have an animal from the zoo to even compare with. So bizarre, so horrific, so dreadful. These English words from the translated to the Hebrew are not going to do it justice. But this is what the words say. Verse 7. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. Dreadful? Well, that sounds bad, but it's worse in Hebrew. It's horrific. It's nightmarish. Dreadful and terrifying. We're doing the best we can with this English translation. Dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. And it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it. It was different. I can't even explain it. It was different from all the beasts, and it had 10 horns. Verse 8, while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. Behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. So, this fourth beast is quite a monster. It had large iron teeth. And again, this is an interesting connection back to the vision in chapter 2, because the fourth beast in the statue had iron in it, and now we have iron teeth. So it's a connection back to that chapter 2 beast. In chapter 2, it had iron feet and legs. And here you have this, the iron teeth. Okay. So its activities, the fourth beast, devouring, breaking in pieces, and stamping. Let's think about this. Devouring, so it eats what it can eat. Okay? It eats whatever can it eat. And if it can't eat it, it breaks it into pieces. If it's not edible, it'll break it into pieces. And when it's done breaking it into pieces, it'll stomp it into oblivion. Complete utter destruction and ferocity. It's truly a nightmare. And as we've said in the previous vision, most commentators and scholars, and I believe that speaks of the nation of Rome. Now, there were 10 horns of this beast. How many toes were on the statue on the vision of chapter 2? There were 10 toes on the bottom part of the statue. There are 10 horns that come out of the fourth beast, and there are 10 toes that come out of the beast in Daniel chapter 2. But somehow there's an 11th horn that's connected to the 10, yet distinct from them, and somehow it displaces three of the horns. So I believe that these 10 horns are probably 10 rulers that come from the nation of Rome in some way, shape, or form. Just like the four heads of the beast represent rulers that came out of Greece. I think there's a consistent pattern here. The rest of chapter 7 is going to bring that out, and chapter 8 as well. So that, I think that little horn then is going to be a ruler as well, that 11th horn. And I think that little horn we'll find is none other than the man of lawlessness found in the book of Thessalonians and known as the Antichrist in the book of 1 John. Since this horn is a ruler and arises from the 10 rulers, and since the Antichrist is still future at this point, it sure makes sense to see the 10 rulers flowing out of the fourth kingdom as still future. However, Rome was in first century. So how do we get Rome and have these 10 heads still be future? This is a big debate in eschatology. And this is going to be a big question that we have to deal with when we come to all of Daniel's prophecy. If that's Rome, how are these 10 rulers coming out of Rome still future? Are they future? How are they connected? They definitely are connected in some way. Because I thought the Roman Empire was no longer around. Is the Roman Empire around in some way today? Is there going to be a resurgence of the Roman Empire at the end? I mean, these questions get us firing up. These questions get us flaming mad. These questions get everybody fighting and debating like you wouldn't believe. We'll see if Daniel cares about this here in a little bit, but for right now, it's interesting to me, and I hope it's interesting to you. The focus in verse 8 is another horn, that little horn, and the fact is this horn possesses eyes like the eyes of a man and probably refers to some kind of wisdom and astuteness and resiliency and a mouth that utters great boasts. This individual, I think it's an individual, a ruler, has a powerful oratorical abilities. It sways people who are listening to him. I think of Winston Churchill mobilizing a nation by his speeches. Perhaps that's a bad illustration. Perhaps Hitler is a better illustration, who convinced nations by his oratorical ability. I think influenced by the Dark One himself, frankly. But that guy could speak if you had the guts to listen to him, which I don't for very long. Hitler looks like a pussycat compared to the man of lawlessness. So, we have the four nations, and I believe a sweep of world history from Babylon, I think, to the very end of time, as we'll see in this chapter. Now remember, this forms an inclusio. The statue is meant to be interpreted with the very end with this statue, or with these beasts. Let's remind ourselves of chapter 2. The head of gold was Babylon. The arms and chest of silver, down from the head down to the lower, was Medo-Persia again, the twofold division with the arms. The belly and thighs of brass was Greece, and the legs of iron was Rome, and the feet and toes were iron and clay mixed together, and there were 10 toes, and there are 10 horns. So, how are these similar from chapter 2 to chapter 7? Well, four empires Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. And notice at the end chapter 2, the climactic, sudden, catastrophic, culminating end of these empires and the establishment of the Messianic kingdom. First, it's a stone that does it. And here, the stone is blown up, and we see exactly all that is meant in about that stone that crushes the feet, and the whole statue comes down in chapter 2. We're going to see all about what that stone means as we come into Daniel chapter 7. But the pattern's the same. The four empires, the Gentile empires, and then the Messianic kingdom at the very end. This is basically what's happening here. Some of the contrasts, well, if you think of the statue, the metals kind of get gold's very valuable, iron's not, and they get less valuable as you go down. And I think what that's speaking of is it's a political thing. You've got Nebuchadnezzar that had all power. He made the laws. He was the law. You have Medo-Persia. The kings had to obey the laws. The laws of the Medo-Persians couldn't change, but the kings themselves were subject to them. And then, of course, you have Greece, and you've got this, you've got a aristocratic politic there, and the power is diffused. And later in Rome, it tends to be some at the end, at least, or some at some point, it tends to be diffused among 10 political heads or nations or individuals that represent nations. On the other hand, those metals become stronger. Gold soft and iron will bust you up. And that's precisely what we see in history with those nations. And I don't know, I don't need to go into detail, but Rome simply went in and crushed everyone. They killed all the men, they ravaged the women, they sold the kids into slavery, they tore the whole place down stone by stone until it was flattened, and when it was flattened, they sowed the ground with salt. Utter, complete, ferocious devastation. And the contrast between the first vision in chapter 2 and the vision in chapter 7 of these is pretty amazing as well. You've got a pagan king seeing the vision, and now you got a godly prophet. That's a contrast. So you've got the kingdoms of the world from the vision of the turmoil of humanity looking up at these as from a human perspective. They're beautiful and they're glorious and they're lustrous. They're all these fancy metals. But from God's perspective, I'll tell you what these nations look like. They come out of a broiling sea of rebellion, and they're absolute monstrosities that all they do is consume and destroy. So you've got God's perspective versus man's perspective. And you've got historical unity with the one statue with the different phases. Now we've got beasts and a different beast in sequential order. We've got more of an order and a diversity between the separate beasts historically. But we still have 10 toes and 10 horns, except Daniel 7 begins to add and give more information and given us this 11th horn, and more information is given. Now, all that's incredibly interesting and amazing. And right now, I hope you're learning something. But here's what hit me. I mean, it hit me hard. I don't know if it's going to hit you hard, but it hit me hard. I'm not supposed to simply be learning something and drawing a diagram so I can photocopy it and give it to you and argue with Lyle later about it. Joking, because we joke about our eschatology all the time. This is meant to make us feel a certain way. This is meant to freak us out and disturb us. This is meant to show us what humanity and the nations are really like. The beastliness and the rebellion of humanity. They're bloody. They're vicious. They're monsters. This is stuff of nightmares. This stuff that wants to keep your light on at night. It's the stuff that wants to make me load my 9mm and put it by my bed. The stuff of nightmares. Not everybody does that. Please don't lose the evil and destruction of the empires of this vision. One scholar says, quotes, verses 1 through 8 are to make an overall impression on you. He wants them to scare you. He wants to register terror as you see these gross and frightful creatures. He seems to be teaching us something about the overall pattern of history. He's certainly not blabbering blithely about progress in history. Rather, he seems to imply that on the whole, nations and kingdoms are out for conflict and control and conquest, that empires are bent to dominate and devour no matter how many people they mangle or how much misery they inflict. End quotes. This section should really discourage you. Let me say that again. You ought to be bummed when you read this and study this. Brothers and sisters, we cannot be encouraged if we are not first discouraged. We cannot be. Now think about this. I tried and I began to weep as I thought of this. You're not, because you haven't tried yet, but go home and meditate on this. We are just numb and distracted and entertained and busy fixing this car and that car, doing this thing and that thing, and we are numb to the horror of what's happening in this world around us and the big picture of what God is doing. We tend to be numb to the horror of this passage. It should make us weep. We think of the Turkish government in 1895 that killed 100,000 Armenians, not Armenians, Armenians. 600,000 died in a day. Heads were placed in vices and squeezed until they were collapsed. That's how they did it. We think of Black Friday during World War II when Japanese troops went through Alexandra Hospital in Singapore and bayoneted all patients, doctors and nurses, and then tied hundreds of Chinese hand to hand and massacred them on the beaches. We think of 1932 and Joseph Stalin demanding grain deliveries from the Ukrainian peasantry. He ruthlessly enforced this grain delivery and forced at least 7 million people to starve to death. We think of Idi Amin and this carnage in Uganda that I will not, in the presence of teenage children, talk about. Teenage children. I haven't even mentioned a man named Hitler and its gas chambers and at least 6 million Jews. We haven't talked about people who had disabilities or couldn't think as well as you can. And they are all massacred as well. Daniel's vision is telling us that human history is beastly and it's scary and it's very clearly realistic. And this is going to get shocking here soon. Because sometimes we get caught up in the eschatological detail and whether we are right or wrong or agree with this person or that person. And Daniel wants us to feel freaked out by this passage. That's what he wants. At least right now, 1 through 8. And all of us want to figure out who the little horn is. Me too, but that's where we're at. Christians are dying all over the world and nations are in turmoil. World history is at a fever pitch, and this text brings us some reality. Now, with all of that in mind, I want you to close your eyes and I want you to worship now, please, and I'm going to read the next section, because the vision is not over. The beauty of Romans 7 is that Daniel 7 is the vision is not over. I kept looking until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. There is a throne room of judgment which received the glory of the Ancient of Days. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. I think we're meant to worship when we read that. I think we're meant to weep when we read that. I think we're meant to stand up and cheer and clap when we read that. Whether we're a-mill, post-mill, pre-mill, we gather and we worship. We praise that our King will win in the end in light of the nightmare of this world and what's happening in our world throughout world history. That's the vision. Of course, Daniel wants an interpretation, and we're going to just give you an overview. Interpretation of the vision in 15 through 28. It's got a cool structure, which I'm not going to go into right now. First, notice Daniel's response. Oh, let's see. Okay, who's the little horn? And, okay, is the Son of Man... Okay. No. It's fine. But don't miss it. Daniel's response is not simply intellectual curiosity, although he has that. He's putting his thinking cap on. But his response is verse 15. As for me, Daniel, watch this. Hold on. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me. And the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So perhaps an angel interpreter here. We're going to get more about that later. This person is named later, I believe. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. And in verses 17 and 18, we get one of the most basic summary interpretations of the entire vision. Verse 17 covers the beasts. Verse 18 covers the Ancient of Days, the destruction of the beast, and the coming of the Son of Man. By the way, the little horn is little when you're sandwiched between the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. He may be big both, but at the end, he's a little horn. It's crazy how just one verse is given to the interpretation of that whole thing at this point. Well, watch this. Verse 17. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. Done. Verse 18, this summarizes the aftermath of that with the Ancient of Days and so on. But the saints of the Highest One will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Isn't it great that if he highlights, not the Ancient of Days, not the coming of the Son of Man, not the destruction, but he highlights our hope because we're hopeless and we're afraid. And we're discouraged, just like the Jews of old in exile were. Is God going to keep his promises concerning us? And he highlights this incredible section, summarizes that aspect of it in verse 18. Now, but let's be honest. Take your beast. If you wanted 3 hours downloading all of the, I won't tell you how many hours I've spent so far in chapter 7, but if you wanted to download and just talk with me of everything I've learned on one of the beasts, which beast would it be? One, two, three, or four?
Four.
Come on, be honest.
Four.
Be honest, it's four. Guess what, Daniel? Daniel didn't care about beast one, two, three. He cared about
four.
So we're in good company. He cares about beast four. And so let's look at it. Which beast you want to know? We want to know about all that? No, we want to know. Daniel felt that same way. Let's look at it. And as we're going to see, Daniel saw a little bit more. We're going to hear more of his vision. It's a supplement to the vision. More. It's like almost like he remembers more of his dream and he writes it down. He's got a fascination with the fourth beast. And frankly, so do we in our study of eschatology. Okay, so we come to verse 19. Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. Now there's like some more. I got more in my dream here. Verse 21. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them, until. Now we're kind of seeing how does that good news part of the vision connect to the dream? And now they begin to overlap a little bit, where we see how the Ancient of the Days and the Son of Man come in to that destruction of the beast that is talked about there. And he's going to tell us more about it. He's waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So Daniel is revealing more than what he saw. But if you go back to the beginning, he desires to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast. So there's that general interpretation. I can see the angels like, I got other things to do. There's battles to win. I'll give you one verse on one and one verse on the other. I got things to do. Daniel says, hold on. What about the fourth beast? I want more interpretation of the fourth beast. I saw a little more. Let me tell you a little more of what I saw. And so he goes back. I desired to know, verse 19, the exact meaning of the fourth beast. And so, all right. I'm going to give you the exact meaning of the fourth beast. I love Daniel's attitude. He wants to know. He wants to know the exact truth. He wants to dig and dig and dig until he finds out and to be given that specific interpretation. So we have the second interpretation of that. Now, specifically of the fourth beast, very specific interpretation starting at verse 23. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom ten kings will arise and another will arise after them. And he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue three kings. He will speak out against the Most High. Well, now the nature of his words are there. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment, the Ancient of Days, in that courtroom scene. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. The burning of the beast. Verse 27, then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. And now we go to Daniel's response again. Verse 28, at this point the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale. But I kept the matter to myself. Now, again, I'm going to push this button a little more. Our response to eschatology and end time study. What is often our response? Often our response is curiosity. Often our response is debate. Often our response is red-faced. Often our response is ignoring it. It'll all pan out in the end. I mean, I could get your feedback on what our responses were, but let me just, what should our response be? I would submit to you that a godly response should be patterned after the godly Daniel. That, if you want to know how to handle eschatology, you've got your chapter. Look at Daniel's response. This is incredible. I learned so much. First thing, Daniel kept looking. He didn't just think it's going to pan out anyway. He kept looking. Present tense, 10 times. He was fascinated. He was interested. He wasn't bored with prophecy, one third of the Bible. He dealt with it. He wanted to know the exact truth of it. Now watch this. Verse 8 says he was contemplating these things. Just write verse 8. Verse 15 says his spirit was distressed. Verse 15, these things were alarming him. Verse 16, he approached the person who knew the answers and he asked tons of questions. If you have an angel that happens to you, come talk to me. Verse 19, he has a desire to know, verse 19. The text says he desired to know. Verse 28, his thoughts were greatly alarming him. Verse 28, his face grew pale, and all these things were so disturbing that he kept the matter to himself. Why was he disturbed? He was disturbed because of the horrific monstrosities of the beasts, yes. But why was he disturbed? Why was his face so pale? Well, the horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering the saints. It's a bit alarming for Daniel to think about the saints of God, the people of God, being overpowered, being worn down, the text says. If a study of the end times makes you lazy, if it makes you cantankerous, if the study of the end times ought to scare you to death, the study of the end times ought to make you holy, study of the end times ought to make you keep looking, and to set your eyes on the coming of the Son of Man. And put your hope in a sovereign God who controls the nations. Well, let me just close with this. And we'll pick it up next time. God is in sovereign control of the nations and the future. That's the whole message of the book of Daniel. The Lord is in control. Now watch this. I told you how horrific humanity is. You ready to hear another statement? God is in control even of the sovereign wicked nations of the earth. How do I know? Because it's the book of Daniel's theme. It's the whole theme of the book of Daniel, and because of what's called divine passives. Divine passives are passive verbs and something's being acted upon, and it's God who's doing it. Okay, verse 4. Its wings were plucked. By whom? Okay, God. A human mind was also given to it. Verse 4. By whom? Verse 6. And dominion was given to it. Who gave the dominion? Verse 11. Until the beast was slain. Who slew the beast? Divine passive. Verse 12. The extension of life was granted to the nations, the horrific nations, these monstrosities. An extension of life was granted them for an appointed period of time. Who granted the extension? God is in control of the monsters of human history. And if God is in control of the monsters of human history, then he's certainly in control of my messy life, his son. Grace Community Bible Church is looking for a new building. What's our future going to be? How's it going to work out? What's going to happen, Dan, with this proposed Bible Institute in Sierra Leone? Are we ever going to church in Tombadu? I mean, are we going to be okay going there? I'm getting nervous to go there. Is Bobby and Danielle's church going to fold? Is Christ Church Vienna in Northeast Vienna? I don't know. It's a hard road home, and there's pain all around us, and history is beastly, and we are pale, and we are alarmed, and we are fearful. Okay. We are fearful and discouraged if we don't have our head in the sand and we're really in the game. It's scary. Listen to me. Let me say that again. If we're amused to death and entertained to death, ignoring the whole thing and not in the game and the purposes of God, and we're not in the game of the big picture purpose of God, pressing light into the darkness in our communities and our families and what's happening in this world, of course we're not scared. God's in control. I'm not scared. That's because I'm watching the Timberwolves. I'm going to watch the Timberwolves later, but don't. Anyways, you get what I'm saying? If you're in the game, you're frightened by the beasts. You're discouraged. You're afraid. And you must then, in faith, set your hope upon God. And it means something that is sovereign. And it means something that he's doing something in the world. And then we can draw hope from the coming of the Son of Man. Instead of debating details, we will worship and weep at the coming of the Son of Man with our Ah Mill brothers and sisters. If we're reading Daniel rightly, this is our perspective. And it gives us a measure of humility heading in. It sure helps to know, doesn't it, that God wins in the end, doesn't it? For you personally, if you're in Christ, and for the church, God's going to win in the end. And that's our great hope. It helps us to remember, as one said, we know the Son of Man who at the same time is the head and shepherd of the fellowship. And this shepherd, the Son of Man, sees the lion coming and the bear and the leopard and the fourth beast, and he will never flee. He will never leave us or forsake us. The Son of Man is coming, but isn't it great that the Son of Man has already come and lives within? We're going to be okay. It's exciting. As is the study of eschatology, if we have the right attitude.